But I really take it on myself to say, let's be good landlords. We don't have to change other people's behavior, but we can control our interactions with tenants. We can control our interactions with the city, commercial tenants, and just improving relationships one at a time, I think, can change the perception or stereotype where somebody says, oh, all landlords are greedy corporations. Well, I just don't think that's true. And if you have a tenant that has had a positive experience, they can hopefully have a counterpoint.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big. Ron Rohde is a commercial real estate attorney with his own firm who also actively invests in industrial warehouse commercial real estate. He currently owns or is a sponsor of 75,000 square feet of fully occupied triple net property in DFW, and he just published his first book on how to start investing in industrial property. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sam. Excited to be here.
Pleasure's mine. Same three questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. Can you quickly tell us, where'd you start, where are you now, and how did you get there?
So I think I started at a pretty early age. My family's always been in real estate on the investment side and doing those things. So I love to tell the story. When I turned 16, my parents said, great, you can have a car. Super excited. But then the first Saturday, they handed me some keys. I had some closing documents. They said, you got to drive this to this tenant. You got to drop off these documents at mortgage company. And you got to meet this contractor at one of our houses and sit in a vacant house for 3 hours. And I said, well, this wasn't quite what I expected for my first Saturday with my car. But this is pre-cell phone days, and you go to the house, and I don't know if anybody's ever sat with a plumber, but those are chatty guys. So I just sit there and listen to him talk. And he says, your parents are great landlords. They always pay me. They don't dispute. And, oh, these tenants are horrible, or these tenants are good, clogging up the drain. All sorts of really interesting handyman stories or plumber stories. And that's really what started my interest in real estate. I always viewed commercial and residential investment as kind of a natural investment path for me. Went to college, law school, and now I have my own practice, and I've always worked in real estate. So over 10 years practicing, always been involved in some form of real estate and real estate investing.
Man, that's fantastic. And kudos to your parents for taking that time to say, hey, they're not throwing you in the deep end, but they are making you earn it out of the gate. And that's, you're really fortunate to have that. So that's fantastic. Mostly on the single family side, is that right? When you were kind of growing up and that's where you kind of cut your teeth?
Yeah. I mean, my parents had everything from office, land, but I would say a lot of single family was the bulk of the portfolio. And I started that way too. There's nothing wrong with it. I think for starting off, if you have a W-2, you have a full-time job, you can start with that. And then at some point, myself and my brother, my partner, we had like 5 properties and an Airbnb. It's just too much to manage. I'm married. We've got 2 young kids. Managing 6 doors is too much when they're kind of spread out as well. And so we sold everything. And luckily, it was good timing in Dallas, but sold everything for appreciation plus the cash flow. And then I recommitted all that equity into the commercial stuff. So
now that's interesting. So you sold that stuff and you guys moved into commercial. What was that first commercial acquisition?
So the first one was a warehouse right outside DFW Airport, 42,000 square foot building, single tenant, net lease. That's a great, great tenant. They're like a national company with $3 or $4 billion in revenue. So good tenant, signed a 5-year lease with a 5 and a 5 extension. And really, to me, it was like buying a occupied property with what I thought was a really strong tenant is the best way to dip your toe in. Because what I hear a lot from investors is single tenants, feast or famine. It's a lot of risk. And I say, yeah, but on the flip side, it's you do your due diligence. You like the building. You like the location. You like the tenant. You could do no work at all. And that's fortunately been our experience. But I kind of like that aspect. If you're going to do all this research and really dig into those tenants, really believe and commit and partner with that tenant, as opposed to saying, well, let's hedge and get a small bay or like 8 multi-tenant and then 6 of them are occupied. It's just very just a different mindset. So again, starting off in commercial, starting off in industrial, I like the single tenant. You get 100% occupancy. You get a long lease, hopefully. And it really goes on autopilot. You can acquire it and then you just cash the checks and pay the mortgage. It's pretty straightforward.
pretty straightforward. And it seemed like it solved the problem that you were having before with the five units in the Airbnb going, hey, wait, this is too much to manage. And so you've gone the full opposite direction of triple net. Like, don't call me, other than I guess if the building's on fire.
Yeah. And I think industrial ware users are probably the least needy in terms of a spectrum. You've got office is way up there. Multifamily, depending on your class, is up there. But industrial users, as long as the roof's not leaking and the trucks can drive, they're not calling you for things and paint chipping off the corner.
Yeah, that's exactly right. What are some of the downsides in investing in triple net property like this?
So I think the biggest downside is, again, having confidence in your underwriting process and really being able to evaluate that tenant or tenants, as well as having the cash reserves that if the building does go dark, I think it's not a zero probability. You don't get to take this graduated decrease or decline in cash flow. If that tenant goes dark, you got zero cash flow and you probably have bills to pay while you're looking for a new tenant and you've got your mortgage. You got a $15,000, $18,000 a month mortgage. Your cash flow goes to zero. So you need to have reserves beyond just the initial equity. You need to have reserves for that type of eventuality. And then the leasing. Triple net leasing is not standard. There's no such thing as to a standard triple net lease. And even brokers that will pitch you a property and say, oh, yeah, you know, Sam, this is a great property. It's triple net. And then you look at the lease and it says, except for the roof, except for this wall, except for the fencing. And you're saying, well, I actually have to maintain a certain amount. That's not what I expected. And the brokers will love to pitch absolute triple net. Well, what does that really mean? And a lot of times how it's presented to you, you won't really know until you've read the lease or you've hired an attorney to do a lease abstract and to give you their opinion, is this a triple net lease or not? So that's probably the two biggest challenges to dipping in. And a lot of people just like multifamily because it doesn't have some of those risks. So
walk us through that from the legal side of things. What is a lease abstract?
So a lease abstract is a document created by a lawyer or a law firm or something. They have some third parties now. And it's basically a 2 to 3 page document that summarizes all of the critical terms. So we're calling like your lease basic terms, your rent per square foot, the length of the lease, any personal guarantees, the approved uses, exclusivity clauses, maybe within an industrial park or retail is more common. But it really just kind of hits the highlights. And it skips maybe boilerplate language about condemnation or casualty loss. What happens if the building gets damaged during the lease term? And we have a lot of language because defining damage, how much damage, who caused the damage, is there a third party, insurance claims, that can take up a page or two of a lease. And so we skip some of those details. They're still important, but not as critical in the lease abstract. So yeah, lease abstract is 2 to 3 pages, just hits the highlights.
Right. It sounds like they leave out the things that maybe, like you said, are important, but don't summarize the bottom line up front, things that could potentially kill the deal. That's okay. That's really interesting. How did you find this initial deal and why was the seller selling?
Yeah. So I think that I'm a little bit lazy in my acquisitions process, but I just know people that bring deals that are too small for their real estate firm. They'll be private equity shops and they're kind enough to say, hey, Ron, do you want this? Deals under $6 million don't really move the needle for them, but it's a good deal and it's a nice product. So that's been the acquisition so far, is just kind of these cast-offs. But to my defense, I will say you have to make it very well known that you are looking for these types of deals. These are your parameters. This is your purchase price. These are your lenders. And you have to tell everybody constantly, hey, Sam, I'm buying warehouse. I'm buying it in DFW. Hey, this is what I'm looking for. Lease terms of at least 3 years plus. And that way, the real estate guys who do come across a deal off market, they'll say, this one isn't a fit for Sam, but Ron keeps telling me he's buying this stuff. Let me email him and maybe I can help him out. So that's how we've done our deals. It's not always scalable, but...
No, man. I mean, but it's a free source of leads. I mean, people are shipping you stuff. Why was the other seller selling it and was it already occupied?
So the building was vacant. So this seller bought the vacant building. I think they probably put $200,000-$300,000 in CapEx to make it suitable, kind of on a spec play, brought the tenant in, signed up the tenant, and then exited. So that was their payday, but they definitely earned it. I feel like in commercial real estate, people are a lot less sensitive to what the seller paid because they've added value. They've just even held it for 9 months and the market has changed. If you're willing to buy at this price, I don't care if the guy bought it 6 months ago and paid half. The value is now, and that's just luck to the seller. You're in the game long enough and you'll get that to happen to you on the other side.
Let's talk a little bit about the size of the deals that you're buying. Industrial is a hot topic right now. And I know you've closed more than this 42,000 square foot property, but what is the opportunity in industrial right now?
So there's opportunity everywhere, I think in every market. But for me personally, and kind of the macro thesis that I believe in is Texas population shifting. I think that remote work is definitely a trend that's going to continue. And it's the thesis really just that buy these occupied properties. And again, they're smaller buildings. So no building is above, say, 100,000 square feet, because they're not building replacement product of sub 100. It's just not cost effective and they're not doing it. So what happens is if there's not new supply coming online in the next 3-5 years, our rents are going to go up if the demand goes up for this type of property. And so that's kind of the macro thesis. And I think location is more important and deal size is around, like, call it the under 6 million, because it's a lot of due diligence and it's a lot of work to chase down. On a $10 million deal, you could do it and make money. But if you're doing it on a five, man, small loan size, and you got to deal with all the same vendors and issues to close. That's where I think you're big enough to where you're avoiding some of the kind of doctors and lawyers just buying it single for themselves, or maybe some 1031. 1031 people, sometimes they don't like tenant. They don't like dirty buildings. They want something new and clean and theoretically easier to manage, but that's a conversation for another day. Their perception is something that maybe doesn't match reality. But that's the sweet spot is, to me, is it has to be big enough to scare off some of the individuals. Sam says, hey, you know, I want to put $1 million down. I want to put $2 million down. They're not really going to want to lever up and buy a $6 million building. But that's where we can kind of play as, for me, is kind of dabbling as a, I won't say it's a hobby, but not a full-time syndicator. I'm not out raising funds every single day, but I can play in that space and build a portfolio that is going to appreciate in 5 years. That's what I want, to re-sign the rents in 5 years.
Right. Yeah. You know, to summarize, it sounds like you're leaving some of the, well, I'll use the term mom and pop competition behind, but yet you're not going out and duking it out with institutional players either. And so there is opportunity in that smaller space. I think it's interesting that you point out that there is just really no new inventory coming online in that smaller space.
Yep. And, you know, we look for inland kind of fill locations. So, for example, you could fit my metrics out in West Texas or East Texas. But when you're buying some of those warehouses, or not buying, but when you're looking at those warehouses, they have vacant land literally 10 miles down the road and 5 miles down the road this way. To me, I just don't see any barriers to entry of, if I want to raise my rent when this tenant leaves, what's to stop the next tenant from just building their own building next door to you, because there's tons of land. And so what we look for is space constrained and not surrounded by abandoned or kind of like vacant uses, like big parking lots. Those could easily be repurposed if I try to push my rents to some crazy, you know, $7 a foot. And they're saying, the guy's like, well, I could buy this dirt and I could build something and have brand new product. But we're all space constrained, so you can't do that close by. You could do that 30 minutes away, but that's 10 miles away and an hour in traffic. So,
right. Yeah, that's really interesting. Thanks for kind of pulling back the curtain on how you analyze and view those properties. How are you funding these opportunities?
Mostly just self, save money and do it that way. But I have a few friends too. I kind of mentioned my ideal client is the two or three guys that come together and put like $200K down each, $250 each, and then buy something. That's kind of how I do it too. So if I'll get a deal, put it under contract, ask around my network, hey, is anybody interested? I'll manage it. This is my track record. I know what I'm doing. Well, usually I'll just like take fees, but not a promote, because I'm not trying to aggressively grow. It's just more opportunistic. And if somebody doesn't like that, then they don't have to invest.
Right. I think that's brilliant. Let's shift gears before we run out of time here. Let's talk about the legal side of things. You're an attorney. You do this every day. Just talk to us about what you're seeing in the market, maybe how things are shifting. Because, I mean, you get to see a lot of transactions and a lot of volume. So just tell us kind of what your state of the union, if you will, is on the commercial real estate side.
I think commercial real estate is booming. It's definitely getting more interest from non-traditional investors, right? It's an alternative asset class in general in terms of the financial world, and everybody's still seeking yield. That hasn't changed. I think industrial is very hot. Warehousing is hot. But my best clients that do really well is they build a thesis for themselves is really narrow. And I think that's the key to being successful. Maybe not multifamily, because you have to be unique. You have to figure out what's your unique advantage when you're bidding on these properties, when you're underwriting. Are you able to pay more than other people? Are you able to close faster? Are you able to close with fewer contingencies? Whatever it is, are you offering all cash, right? But multifamily is very hot and still is very hot. Industrial is hot. What I'm seeing, and I think I have a YouTube video about this, but office is still really an opportunity. I think that people are getting back to work, and even a hybrid remote scenario for most companies, they're going to reduce the size of their footprint, right? So as these leases come up, tenants are willing to leave their building. They're willing to relocate either out of one main headquarters and doing like a couple satellite, or just reducing their footprint in general. And that means, to me, there's an opportunity to re-sign tenants in a new building. And so if you could buy this office building at 50% occupancy, maybe put in some CapEx, but more so just understanding that you need to be aggressive in marketing. Tenants are moving or making changes, and that's opportunity for the office owners. And I have a couple of clients that are taking that bet in their own way, but that's really kind of exciting. Same for retail. We've had a full cycle, a full 18 months to look at what's been COVID proof, what's been Amazon proof, and the retail centers that are in demand, we're signing leases and they're not, the landlords aren't giving any concessions. I mean, we say, hey, COVID. And they're like, we don't care. We're completely full. We're building out our second phase. And it's really, again, kind of this feast or famine mentality on the retail side. The grocery store anchors, the high-end stuff has proven really resilient and is in demand. If you're a Class C, kind of a rough tenant mix, you might be struggling. You're really struggling to fill those doors where you used to have a nail salon and a donut shop, and now nobody is patronizing those businesses. So the retail is an opportunity as well, but that's what we're seeing. You know, I think prices are just going to keep continuing to stay strong until interest rates actually change, because right now there's just too much money. And people are very comfortable with this pricing now. And you tell them, hey, you're buying this at a 5 cap, just shrug their shoulders and say, okay, I'll just buy. And previously, people would just be shocked and say, no, there's no way. You're in Dallas. That is not a tier 1 city. I'm not paying a 5 cap for that. And now people are saying, well, that's reality.
Yeah, that's intriguing. Thanks for coming to give us the background on that. Before we jump here into the final 4 questions, Ron, is there any parting thoughts or advice that you would give to our listeners?
I really just would advise people to build your own thesis. I mean, really think about that and how your thesis is different than other people. And it's perfectly okay that you're not different, but you should also understand what you're giving up in terms of your goals of number of deals per year. If you are really picky and you only want this Class B, Class C value add multifamily, and you have financing contingencies and all this, you might not do a deal for another 12 months. And are you okay with that? Or could you go to another market? Could you go to Waco, Texas? Could you compromise somehow while still maintaining your thesis? And I think that's really just the big thing, because a lot of people hear the high level stuff, but macroeconomics, it doesn't matter. I mean, unless you're deploying $500 million or $1 billion into a region, macroeconomics are great. You're going to make more money on a specific deal, and making sure that that deal fits your investment thesis. The rest of the market could crash, but if your deal has good tenants and they're an essential business, you're going to keep making money. And you say, I don't care that hotels are failing left and right. My hotel's fine. So yeah, that's my advice. Focus on your individual deal.
Yeah, that's really sound. I like that a lot. Final 4 questions are this. If I gave you just $20,000 to invest in real estate, what would you do with it and why?
I guess I would try to buy like a duplex, live in one side and rent out the other while I renovate the side I'm in. I never kind of had that opportunity or inclination when I was younger, but gosh, I kind of wish I could go back and live like a rough life, no flooring, no counters, and just sacrificing like that. And then once I renovated that unit, try to switch with the other tenant or raise their rate, and then maybe they move out and then I move into the other unit, rent out at higher rents. And then you have a fully cash flowing, fully renovated house that you've done with your own two hands. And then you can still buy another property to live in. And then that duplex will pay your mortgage on the place that you live in by yourself. And just as a home base, you'll be miles ahead of everybody else. You won't have nearly as much pressure from cash flow, and you'll have a really good understanding of how to do all those things. So 20 grand, probably can't buy a fourplex, but buy a duplex and tough it out. Go camping.
Love it. Love it. That's great. Question number two is this: if you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
The advice to avoid a mistake is really just not understanding what tools are available at your disposal. And I mean that for vendors. I mean that for professionals, for lawyers, for accountants, for advisors, anybody, right? There's this wealth of tools in people's toolbox today, and they don't really understand what they can do with them and what they can't do. So it's just intimidating. You're trying to build a house and you walk into Home Depot, you've got aisles and aisles of these tools, and it's, I think it's option overload. But the reality is you kind of need to go to, if your budget's limited or you're starting out or whatever, go to that Swiss Army knife and just pick up that one tool, because you're not putting in 1,000 drywall screws an hour. You don't need a heavy duty power drill, but you also maybe don't even need a full set of dedicated screwdrivers. You just need the Swiss Army tool to be cost effective and for you to really know how to use that screwdriver really well. So that's a mistake. I really think people overpay for certain things and they underpay for other things. And that's really frustrating to me, because I see it all. And then they're complaining, but I'm saying, well, it's kind of your fault.
Right. Understood. That's great. Question number three is this: when it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
So I really take it on. Some of my clients are like residential landlords, rent to buy, build to rent. Some of my clients are build to rent, and they're in this residential space where there's a lot of political discussion about what is the role of landlords and what is rent and who should bear that brunt. But I really take it on myself to say, let's be good landlords. We don't have to change other people's behavior, but we can control our interactions with tenants. We can control our interactions with the city, commercial tenants, and just improving relationships one at a time, I think can change the perception or stereotype where somebody says, oh, all landlords are greedy corporations. Well, I just don't think that's true. And if you have a tenant that has had a positive experience, they can hopefully have a counterpoint.
Right. That's great. I love that. Last question, Ron, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, learn more about you or your law firm, what is the best way to do that?
I'd say the best way is my YouTube channel. I put out a lot of content to kind of help people start on the journey, or I try to do like really detailed, but find me on YouTube. And then I have all my contact information. You can reach out to the law firm, Ronald Rohde Law.
That's awesome. Ron, thank you so much for your time today. This has been fantastic. I do appreciate it. You have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen. If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.